Good morning, everyone. Really is nice to see all of you. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you for that music, Brandon. And again, just been a real pleasure. We've been in North Carolina since Wednesday evening, and we have seen everything in the state. We put 700 miles on a rental car since we arrived. So I've seen more of North Carolina than you have. And it's truly a beautiful state. We've been treated very well. We've eaten and eaten and eaten. We have not missed any meal since we've been here. We've been treated very, very well. We were saddened we couldn't come back in February. And when we were unable to make that, we were not feeling well and were unable to come for your special social. We thought, well, maybe we could come for Pentecost. I'm not sure if we were invited or not, but we came anyway. It's a little difficult for a pastor when I call them up and say I want to come for them to say no. So I really don't know if Mr. Kelly invited us or not, but who cares? we're really happy to be here. You know, it's strange for me these days to travel to different areas, and you see people, and they're not where you think they should be, and you say, well, what are you doing here? Oh, I didn't mean it that way, you know. And we saw a few of those people here today. In fact, if we'd known that Mr. and Mrs. Blake, Paul and Shirley were here, we would have gone to Raleigh for services today. But anyway, it's nice to see them, and good to see faces that you know from the past. We did have the opportunity, and of course, we've known two of the Baker brothers, Dave and Jeff, for probably 25 years, had an opportunity to meet his parents while we were here. And as soon as we got in their home, before Mr. Baker even said hello, he said, you look a lot taller on video. Now, that's a euphemism for you sure are short. But that's okay. That's not the worst that's happened, by far. A couple of years ago, and I've told this before, in Orange Beach, after giving the sermon, an individual came up, and you know when someone wants to talk to you privately, sort of stand off to the side. And so I kind of walked over, and he walked up and introduced himself to me, and he said, can I tell you something personal? Now, let me stop there for a moment. If anyone ever says that to you, say no, because it will never be good. So he said, you sure look a lot better on video than you do in person. Now, I didn't know how to address that, so I simply ended the conversation. But it's always interesting meeting people in different places, and, of course, a lot of people you know from over the years. And that's really a wonderful thing. And these days, when we go to just about any church area and visit, there always seem to be people there that we know or have known over the years. It's really a family, and we truly enjoy it. And just have a great time. So we've really enjoyed this weekend. We were in Raleigh yesterday and, of course, here today and seeing all of the brethren and of course, seeing some of the sights in your beautiful state. So it's been very, very good for us. I thought this morning before I get to the sermon, I'd give you some updates from the office and some things that are going on. It's been quite a remarkable year for the church. A lot of things have happened. I think, as you know, we moved into an office, a suite of offices in Allen, Texas, actually, is where we're located. Obviously, it's just north of Dallas. You don't know, really, when you go from one place to another. It's all one large city in that sense. But Allen's a very nice little area. That's where we have the office. We moved in there in March of 2012. And so we just passed our sixth anniversary in the office. And while it's been just a wonderful time in so many ways, we've seen a lot of advances. We've seen a lot of things come together, and we've had really, really a wonderful time in so many, many ways. God has been very good to us. He's blessed us exceedingly. We've seen increases each year since we began, and we've really seen some things happen in the last few months that I want to share with you. Now, we do our very best to give you regular updates, in accord, one accord, a member letter each month, a building update every couple of weeks, and we give a financial update at least quarterly. Mr. Taylor will give a presentation. So we're doing our very best to keep everybody informed. We want to share whether it's, hopefully it's mostly good news. I think it is. But even when it's not so good news, we want to share with all of you. If we're truly a family, then we should be able to share all of that. There's nothing that we can't share with the church, and that's what we, of course, do our best to do. We had the Foundation Institute graduation last week. We actually had our 100th graduate of Foundation Institute last week, which was a bit of a milestone for us as we, of course, get ready now for another year. So that was quite a good thing. We also just returned a couple of weeks ago from a trip to Chile, and that was another wonderful experience. It was our third international leadership conference. We're doing these actually around the world. We began in Latin America. We've held three in Latin America, the last one being in Chile. We've had a total of 160 individuals attend the classes and lectures. They will now follow up with a live class on Sundays every quarter from the office. And it's a program that's will last about 18 months, from which we certainly pray there will be fruit. And we're looking diligently for young leaders, new leaders, younger individuals. We've been very distressed, I say distressed in some ways, over the last year because we lost three pastors to death. And that was totally unexpected. Two of them outside the United States. And to give sort of a comparison, we have in the Church of God, a worldwide association, we have 75% of all of the elders live in the United States and 25% outside the United States. But our attendance is half and half. 50% of our attendance in the U.S. with 75% of the elders, 50% of our attendance outside the United States with 25% of the elders. So in some areas you have individuals who pastor several countries. We have congregations in those countries, but no elders, no deacons. It's simply a very, very difficult thing. Recently we lost the pastor in the Philippines, Mr. Norman Ulagay. Very sad, a sudden heart attack that caused his death, and we haven't replaced Mr. Ulagay yet. He was pastoring the central part of the Visayas area of the Philippines, and we've not been able to replace him as of yet. He was actually our youngest elder, I believe, and he was certainly our newest pastor, and that was a very tragic event. So the whole point was there's really a crisis, certainly outside the United States. We're doing certainly better in the United States as far as bringing on new men, younger individuals into the ministry, and actually beginning to assign some of them. But outside the United States, it's very difficult. So this program is to take leadership development around the world. There are actually 10 regions of the world that we will actually go to between now and next summer. And then we'll follow it up with a series of 7 classes that will be taught from the headquarters office. And again, with the hope that fruit will come from it. This is sort of an effort by us to, you might say, jumpstart the development of new leaders for the future. And as I said, we've had 160 men and wives attend so far the first three. And that, of course, those numbers will grow as we go to different places around the world. We've also hired 4 men this year for the ministry, going back to the fall of last year to this time. 2 of them are actually in their 30s, early 30s. So it's been a long time since we had individuals who we hope will be pastoring congregations within a year or so in their 30s. Now, that's a long cry from the way it used to be in the early years. I was ordained at age 23. I was pastoring a church at age 24. Who on earth would listen to a 24-year-old as their pastor? The members were very forgiving in those years. I don't think, well, I shouldn't say that. Maybe not as forgiving today, but very forgiving back in those days when we were there. But to have two new men, they were elders that we've hired full-time. And then, again, 2 who are a little older than that, but certainly still younger. So that's going to help a lot in the United States. Of course, we lost 1 pastor in the U.S. as well, and we really haven't replaced Mr. Carey. We've had pastors in the surrounding area sort of pick up more responsibility. So those are our needs, and we're doing our very best to do that. I mentioned earlier that when it comes to our finances, some remarkable things have been occurring. We certainly give God the credit. We don't take credit for that at all. But it seemed to have begun. We've had an increase every year since we began, but our average increases were 4 to 6% per year. Since last, well, of course, the beginning of this year, we're now in the month of May, as of Friday, May the 18th, our increase for this year is 20%. Our income has increased by 20% ahead of last year at this point in the year. Now, that was unexpected. We certainly haven't had a 20% increase in attendance, but the income has. We had our largest December last December when things seemed to have really begun to change in that sense. It began to increase. January was our largest January ever. February was our second largest February ever. March was double the income from last year and by far our largest. April was the largest April ever, and May is on track to be the largest May ever, leading to it at this year-to-date as of Friday, an increase of 20%. Now, I received some advice many years ago that you should not get too excited when things are going well and are too discouraged when things aren't going well, that the history of the church has always had ups and downs and that there will be trials and difficulties ahead. You can count on those. But for now, as I said today, God has truly blessed us. We've also had, I believe, very good management of our resources. We're actually 3% under our budget for expenditures. So you can do the math, 20% over for income and 3% under for our expenses puts us at a very, very strong and very positive, certainly first 5 months of the year of, you know, a difference of 23%, and that to the good. So that's very good. I also have told people that God seems to do these things, especially when we need them. And, of course, building this building has been a bit of a, not a leap of faith, but obviously faith that certain things are going to occur. And they certainly have. And whenever there's been something out of the ordinary that we didn't expect, we've always had the ability to do that. So at this point, and of course the building, we got started 2 months late, but essentially we've been on track since that time. They should be pouring the slab, the foundation, here within the next few days. All of the pad has been prepared. The steel was being put in the what will be the foundation. Piers have been dug, and they're all around the foundation, 26 piers that go down about 14 or 16 feet to bedrock, and also a sort of a concrete apron that goes around a part of it, and then, of course, the slab sits on top of that. So all of that should be done here shortly. There have been various surprises from the local city government, the city commission of McKinney, Texas, which it's a city that's just growing so fast that it's hard to keep up with it. And, of course, they're trying their best to control growth, which I appreciate that, but they always have some odd things that they seem to want from us that they don't tell us until, oh, by the way. So every couple of weeks you get this, oh, by the way, type of response. Oh, by the way, you have to build a bike path the entire length of your property. That goes nowhere. There's no beginning to it. There's no end to it. It's just your property. And so, again, you say, well, why do we have to do that? Well, we want it to be pretty. Well, we thought it was pretty without a bike path. So you have to have a bike path. There seems like there's always something where it's bringing power to the property. This property is virgin area, 7.4 acres. Nothing's ever been built on it. It used to be pasture land a few years ago. It's right between two freeways. In fact, the southern part of the property we didn't want at all. It's a beautiful property. 5 acres is very open. It's beautiful. That's what we wanted. The 2 acres, which borders on a freeway, we didn't really want. The owner finally said, you have to buy it all or none. So, okay, well, we'll buy it all. Well, lo and behold, about a year after we bought it, we discovered or we were told that the value of that property has tripled so that we can actually sell the 2 acres and pay for virtually the entire 7.4 acres. Which is what we'll consider doing since we don't need the 2 acres. There's a lot of other development going on in the area. So it's really a beautiful piece of property. We informed the city, which was I'm sure the right thing to do, that we hope to one day build another building and an auditorium on the property on the north side. They said, okay, if you're going to do that, then we're going to require you to put underground drainage for the whole thing. So, you know, well, we may not do that for 10 years. We don't care. Now that you've told us, you have to put underground drainage because there's going to be a lot of concrete in there. So, you know, it's everything seems to be 40,000 here, 40,000 there, or something like that. So we'll put in, which is probably a good thing. We'll have it all set for any future development. But those things came up. We didn't expect them. But every time they came up, again, the extra funds were there. We've been able to cover everything to this point without taking anything away from preaching the gospel or caring for the churches. So that's been a wonderful thing. So God's truly blessed us. I certainly want to thank all of you for your generous support and help in all that we're doing. And as I said, we certainly don't take any credit for it. God has been just really merciful to us, and really we've had a really good position at this point in time. Now that could change. Obviously, we know there'll be trials and difficulties. There's nothing in life, it seems, that's actually easy, and so we anticipate those as well. But God has certainly allowed us to be in a position where we should be able to handle whatever comes and be able to have a building. Target date for completion will be after the Feast of Tabernacles this year, and hopefully between the feast and the first of the year, we should actually be in the new building. And we're looking forward to that. When we began in March of 2012, we had 4 employees in the office. We now have 23 employees. We have no more space, and we have people sharing offices. We have 2 people kind of staring at each other on either side of their desk, which would be kind of an odd setup, but that's how we handle some of that. So, but thank you again for all you've done. Appreciate it, again, certainly feel very blessed to be here with all of you on the day of Pentecost. A number of years ago, there was a book that came out, and the book had to do with learning, how people learn. And this is what the author had to say about learning. The title of the book is A Learned Ministry, written by Marjorie Sukaki. And she said this: "We teach our children the things of God 1 hour a week. Seldom do we require homework or accountability for what is learned. If we taught mathematics or reading in the same way that we teach religion, parents would rise in a furor demanding change. But seldom do parents protest that education in Christianity is not rigorous enough. Knowing little themselves, they require little of their children. If you consider God's holy days and how that knowledge and that information is given to us, not just once a year, but 7 times a year, as we meet on all of the festivals during the year. There was a time in the Church of God, going back to the Radio Church of God, Mr. Baker gave some of that history, where the church kept the holy days, but didn't really know why. The knowledge of what they meant, especially the Feast of Tabernacles, was lost or was not known. Mr. Armstrong said certainly in his autobiography, when that small group of the Radio Church of God, which began actually during the Feast of Tabernacles in 1933, and somewhat kept the feast that year as a group, 21 of them, that they didn't know why. The Feast of Tabernacles, that is. Now, you could figure out some of the festivals. Passover was pretty easy. You know, the Bible tells us the death of Jesus Christ. The days of unleavened bread, you know, pretty clear analogy of leaven and sin. Maybe Pentecost, with, of course, Pentecost even observed by Protestant churches. They have a Pentecost Sunday observance where they do, of course, refer back to the receiving of the Holy Spirit. But then you get to the fall festivals. Trumpets. Well, what does that mean? The Bible doesn't say. There's nowhere in the Bible, that it directly connects the Feast of Trumpets with the return of Christ. That comes much later when you see, you know, the prophecies of the trumpets and all of that. Then you come to the Day of Atonement. Well, Satan is bound. We understand that. That's part of prophecy as well. But the Feast of Tabernacles, what does that mean in God's plan? Now, Mr. Armstrong was beginning to understand that there is a plan and that the holy days are part of that plan. But what they meant had escaped him, had escaped the church during all of those years. In fact, it wasn't until 1945 that the Church of God came to the realization, or certainly Mr. Armstrong directing them, that the Feast of Tabernacles required them to leave their homes. Up until that time, they kept the feast at home. They had a little church there in Eugene, Oregon. And they would have a service in the evening during the feast for those who could come. And they would have a holy day service, obviously for those who were in the area, but you stayed home. You worked your job. You didn't take off work during that period of time. In 1945, Mr. Armstrong announced something that was startling to the church. In fact, it was so startling that there were many that just couldn't accept it. Mr. Armstrong realized or came to understand that the Feast of Tabernacles pictured the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. And as a church, we should actually leave our homes, go to a temporary dwelling for the 7 days plus the last great day. That was shocking to the church. In fact, the attendance fell quite dramatically in the years of 1945 and 1946. Of course, in 1946, Mr. Armstrong shocked the church again by announcing he was moving out of Oregon to California, and the attendance dropped again. The attendance for the Feast of Tabernacles in those days had been rising to about 60 to 70 to 80 people. All of a sudden, it dropped back to 40 people again, and it was like starting all over. But Mr. Armstrong was convicted that the holy days tell a story, and he spoke about that. My first memory of Mr. Armstrong explaining the plan of salvation was as a 12-year-old sitting in at that time, the metal building in Big Sandy, Texas. And it was so clear as he would begin the feast by asking, well, why are we here? And then he would explain each holy day, each festival, and what it meant in God's plan. Even as a 12-year-old, it was captivating because it made sense. It made perfect sense that there's a story being told. The Bible is a series of stories. It's a story about life. And I've done a lot of funerals over the years, and I normally talk about that. The Bible is a book about life, not about death. It begins with the story of the tree of life, and it ends with the story of the tree of life. And everything in between is about life. Oh, there are difficulties laid out. There are other things that happen, but it's a story about life. Why would God then not encapsulate that whole story in seven festivals? It made sense. As a 12-year-old, I understood it. And then every year we heard it repeated over and over again. The quote I read about learning, it's very important. Obviously, God created us. He knows how we learn. People learn by something being taught. People learn by taking notes on something, writing something down, maybe actually writing down or maybe mentally making notes. But they learn better. You know, it's proven over and over again. The true method of learning is to be involved, where you actually practice it. That's when you learn. You know, you can teach someone about an experiment, you know, in chemistry or whatever. But they really don't get it, at least not well, until they've actually done that experiment themselves. You know, I took a course in chemistry, or it probably took me instead of me taking it. But that was where you really learned. You know, when you blew up the test tubes, you learned it as to what works and what doesn't and how it works. And you remembered that. Still have a scar on my finger where I blew up a test tube back in ninth grade chemistry class. I'll always remember that. And I remembered what I did wrong. And I would never do it again. But that's how you learn. So it makes sense that God gives us holy days, gives us festivals that tell a story, that you're involved in the story. You're not reading a book about someone's experiences. It's your experience. And today, you know, it's borne out. You talk about having attended the Feast of Tabernacles in, you know, your first year, whatever that may have been. And there's a story that's come through your life. I've always found it interesting that there is a particular pattern to the seven festivals. Think about this. The holy days or the festivals begin each year with a one-day festival, Passover, followed immediately by a seven-day festival, Unleavened Bread. Then you have one holy day, Pentecost, one holy day, Trumpets, one holy day, Atonement, and then you have a seven-day festival and one holy day to end. So it doesn't matter which direction you go from, it's the same pattern. 1-7-1-1-1-7-1. 1-7-1-1-1-7-1. It's a pattern. There's a story. You begin at the beginning, but whether you begin at the end or begin at the beginning, it's the same pattern. And the middle of that pattern is the Feast of Trumpets, number 4. which is the central event for human history yet to occur, the return of Jesus Christ. That's the middle. Everything that flows after that flows from that. Everything before that flows toward that. It's a story. Here we are today on the third festival of the year. It's called by a variety of names. It's known as the Feast of Weeks in the Old Testament. In the book of Numbers, chapter 28, it's called the Day of First Fruits. It's also called, again, the Feast of Weeks. It's also in the book of Exodus called the Feast of Harvest. And in the New Testament, it's called Pentecost. So the Day of First Fruits, the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Harvest, and Pentecost in the New Testament. It's the only festival that has that many names that I can think of. It's also the only holy day that doesn't occur on a set date. The only one. The day's interesting because we are here today on Sivan 6. The Jews are celebrating today as Pentecost. That happens periodically. It happens in any year, when the first day of unleavened bread falls on the Sabbath. Then that year we will meet on the same day, or we will celebrate Pentecost on the same day the Jews do. They keep Pentecost on Sivan 6. We keep Pentecost on the 50th day from the wave sheaf offering, which is the first Sunday after the Passover. Not a set date, therefore we don't come to a set date. We keep Pentecost some years in May, as we are this year. Next year it'll be in June. Doesn't appear on the same date on the calendar. That's by design. As I said, this is one of those unusual years in which Sivan 6 and our observance of Pentecost is the same day. Pentecost is the only festival that actually was changed after many years of observing it on a Monday, was changed to a Sunday in 1974. It's never happened. Any other festival, certainly not in modern history. In fact, you may want to discount me after I say this, I was ordained on the last Monday, Pentecost. I hope it was valid. That was 44 years ago, not today as the date, but 44 years ago. It was actually in June of 1973, the last Pentecost on a Monday. Beginning in 1974 and for the past 44 years, the church has observed Pentecost on a Sunday. How did that happen? It's a remarkable history of this particular day. It is one of the more controversial of the festivals that occurs each year. Controversy often revolving around how to count 50 days. It was interesting that from 1933 or 34 until 1973 or through 1973, the church had a very simplistic way of counting based on what we saw in Scripture. And that count was an exclusive count. That is, the word from in English, we took it to be what it says. If I tell you 7 days from today we will hold a service, then you would know that's next Sunday. That's 7 days, not counting today. The Hebrew for the word from is, there are variations of it. Mi or Mimi Horoth is the Hebrew. And it was determined with more thorough study that that actually means beginning with. So the actual phrase there in Leviticus would be beginning with or beginning on the Sunday after the Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread, or the first Sunday after Passover as the wave sheaf. And when that knowledge became available in 1973 and then in 1974, the church continued from that point to do what we would call an inclusive count. In other words, the day of the wave sheaf is the first day. And we were totally convinced of that, still are convinced of that, that that's the correct way to count. That's been now for 44 years. What do you know about today? What does this day mean to you? If we only had the Old Testament, we would come to certain conclusions about this day. The fact that we have the Old Testament and the New Testament, we come to slightly different conclusions about this day. First of all, we should deal with the various names. As I said, in Numbers chapter 28, let's turn there first. Numbers chapter 28, verse 26, you'll see certain names used. regarding this particular day. Numbers chapter 28, verse 26. It is referred to in this one section of Scripture as the Day of First Fruits, and also it's called the Feast of Weeks. Notice verse 26. Also on the day of the first fruits, when you bring a new grain offering to the Lord at your Feast of Weeks, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work. So a part of what happens on this day, again, dealing with the Old Testament first, is that it was called the Day of First Fruits. Well, what does first fruits mean? First fruits are simply defined as the first to come forward, the first fruit or grain harvested. Now, in Israel at that time, or in that Middle East at that time, the spring harvest, you have to be careful. You know, you travel down to Chile, and they don't like for you to use the term spring or fall harvest, because to them, tabernacles is the spring harvest. And we have the spring here is their fall, because, again, being the southern hemisphere. So sometimes you have to be careful, but the scriptures were written based around the Middle East, based around that area, which meant the first harvest of the year was grain, barley and wheat primarily. The fall harvest was vegetables and fruit. And it was by far the biggest harvest. It provided the most sustenance, the most obviously food. When you had all your vegetables and your fruit being harvested in the fall, that was a big part of their diet. But it was the grain that was harvested in the spring. But there were first fruits of both. And certainly the interesting part about the day of first fruits is that Pentecost is not really the end of the harvest. Some get confused on that, thinking, well, if it's the end of the harvest, that means the resurrection must occur at Pentecost. That means Christ must return either secretly or whatever they may come up with. That's simply not true. The harvest doesn't end on Pentecost. The physical harvest doesn't. Pentecost was the two loaves, which were the first fruits of the wheat harvest. The wave sheaf was the first fruit of the barley harvest. And the two are slightly different. They follow each other. They're in the same season, but they're not exactly the same, and they don't occur at the same time. So Jesus Christ, representing the wave sheaf, or the wave sheaf that occurs on the Sunday after the Passover, during the days of unleavened bread, has a slightly different meaning than by the time you get to Pentecost. In fact, the Jews today refer to the wave sheaf as the Feast of First Fruits, although the Bible never refers to it as a feast. And they refer to Pentecost as the Feast of Weeks, because it's 7 weeks later, or seven Sabbaths, plus another day afterwards. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. The idea of first fruits is significant when it comes to understanding the spiritual meaning of what God is doing in His plan. As in a physical harvest, there are first fruits, or there's the first part of the harvest. So in God's plan, there are first fruits referred to. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, notice verse 20. But now Christ is risen from the dead and has become the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. So on the wave sheaf, the day of the wave sheaf, they take the first fruits of the barley harvest. The priest and the Levites have to go out into the fields and cut a portion of ripe grain of barley. They have to bring it back to the temple, and there's an elaborate ceremony of waving this. Nothing can be eaten of the barley harvest until the wave sheaf has been offered. Now, when you think about that, it's quite a test of faith to know that, well, here is the first fruit. There's no guarantee there will be a harvest to follow. I mean, anything could happen. You cannot touch that harvest or that grain until after the wave sheaf has been waved. So Jesus Christ is clearly the wave sheaf. He clearly is. Verse 21. For since by man came death, by man also came the resurrection of the dead. Verse 22, for as in Adam all die, even so in Christ all shall be made alive. But each one in his own order. Christ the first fruits, afterward those who are Christ in his coming. The barley harvest, or the waving of the wave sheaf, was evidence there's more coming. There will be a harvest, but it hasn't occurred yet. the sacrifice of Jesus Christ and his resurrection, becoming the wave sheaf offering, ascending to heaven on that Sunday after the Passover, tells us that there will be a harvest to follow. It's by faith that we know that. It didn't end with Jesus Christ. In fact, we know that Jesus Christ is the beginning of God's plan. That's the beginning of the story. So each in his own order, Christ the first fruits, afterward those who are Christ that is coming. Now they're also first fruits. Just as the wave sheaf is a first fruit of barley, you come to Pentecost, you have the first fruit of the wheat. But it's baked in two loaves. And whereas the wave sheaf is during the days of unleavened bread, therefore there is no leavening, the two loaves are baked with leaven on the day of Pentecost. The first fruits of the wheat harvest. Christ is the wave sheaf. There's another harvest to follow. Another harvest to follow. There are all kinds of analogies that can be drawn from that. But now the second meaning of the feast, the second title, you might say, of the feast, it's called the Feast of Weeks, or Shavuot is the term. That's also found, look at Numbers chapter 28, verse 26. We read that previously, but let's go back there, and you'll see that the two primary references to Pentecost is the Feast of Weeks, seems to be the primary one. And then you also, as I said, it's called or referenced as the Day of First Fruits, Numbers 28, verse 26. And also on the Day of the First Fruits, when you bring a new grain offering to the Lord at your Feast of Weeks, you shall do no customary work. So it's a holy day. But what does it mean, Feast of Weeks? Well, the Hebrew term is Shavuot. It's found, let's go to Leviticus chapter 23. You'll find the term there in reference to the Feast of Weeks. It's a particular term that's used in the Hebrew, Leviticus 23, and look at verse 15, where we have the instructions for Pentecost. We're dealing with the Old Testament. I first want to establish, what did all this mean in the Old Testament? Because that becomes the foundation of what we're going to see that it means when we get to the New Testament. There's some very important scriptural concepts in the Old Testament that really provide us the background and the backdrop to what this day actually means. Leviticus 23, verse 15, you shall count for yourself from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, seven Sabbaths shall be complete. The word seven there actually comes from, again, it's a variation of the word Shavuah. Actually, in Numbers 28, verse 26, the Hebrew term is Shavuah. It literally means 7 weeks of Sabbaths. In other words, these are complete weeks that end with a Sabbath. So you're to count 7 of those weeks. Each one ends with a Sabbath. That comes to 49. But you remember, you must count the first day. That Sunday must be day one, or you don't have 7 complete. If you wait until Monday to count day one, you're off by a day. This is what the church came to understand in 1974. That it has to be 7 complete weeks that end in a Sabbath. If you start on a Monday, you will not end on a Sabbath with the 7th day. Starting on Sunday, though, you always will end with a Sabbath. So you have 7 of those are completed. And then the next day, which is a Sunday after the 7th Sabbath, is the Feast of Weeks. Called, therefore, because it is the festival that follows 7 complete weeks of Sabbaths. Which means it must begin on Sunday, must end on Saturday. And with 7 of those, and then one more day, we always will observe Pentecost on Sunday. Not the same date of the month, but it'll always be on Sunday. You're to count this. The idea that you are to count is a clear indication that it's not a set day in the month. And yet the Jews observe it on Sivan 6. They ignore the concept of counting. They declare that the Sabbath is the first day of unleavened bread, which is the 15th day of the month. Therefore, they always count beginning with the 16th day of the month, and therefore they end up with Sivan 6 every year. But it's not correct. So Feast of Weeks is important. Between the Day of First Fruits and the Feast of Weeks, we see something significant that God is doing. He's telling us a story. And this story requires concentration. You know, you have to count the days. You have to pay attention to where the next step of the story is. The Jews, in their literature, will connect Passover with Pentecost. In fact, in their literature, they will tell you that Passover ends on Pentecost. They connect it all together. Because it's after Passover that you have the wave sheaf. The wave sheaf leads you to Pentecost. Therefore, Pentecost, Passover, and unleavened bread are all the same. Not all the same, but are all a part of one continuous story. Which is interesting. It's also called, as I said in Exodus 23, it's called the Feast of Harvest, Pentecost is. As opposed to the Fall Festival, which is called the Feast of Ingathering. Feast of Harvest, Feast of Ingathering. One is much more substantial. The Feast of Ingathering, of course, there's a substantial amount of produce. Whereas the Feast of Harvest is harvesting grain. Two different things. Two different purposes. But very significant, each one. But that's the Old Testament. Let's go to Acts chapter 2. The third primary term. There are actually four terms that are used. Feast of Weeks, Day of First Fruits, although not that often, but Day of First Fruits is referred to. Then you have, of course, the Feast of Harvest, and then you have Pentecost. Acts chapter 2, verse 1. The Jews who gathered, or those who gathered on the day of Pentecost, were still reflecting on the Old Testament. They still had in their minds what Pentecost meant previously. Remember, there is no New Testament in Acts chapter 2. There is no Apostle Paul to read. There's nothing to tell us what all this means. But as the Jews gather, or those who were there were Jews and Gentiles there who were proselytes, as they gather on the Feast of Pentecost, in their minds, they're there, as they do every year, to observe this festival from the Old Testament. Acts 2, verse 1. We have it introduced, though, with a different name. When the day of Pentecost had fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. They were there celebrating the Old Testament festival, the Day of First Fruits, the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Harvest. And they would have had all of those concepts in their minds. Now we introduce it as the Day of Pentecost. Pentecost is simply, of course, the Greek term for counting 50 or 50 days. Nothing any more significant than that, except it confirms that it is a Feast of Weeks that required a count to arrive at the 50th day. So wherever you see Pentecost, wherever you see, again, the Old Testament references, there's always the implication that there's a harvest and that it requires you to count 50 days. Now, anyone who's ever been on a farm or ever worked in agriculture, you know that harvests don't begin and end in quite that neat a manner. Pentecost was never, well, I shouldn't say never, but it was generally not the end of that harvest. Wheat does not operate on a 50-day schedule. Depends on a lot of issues, whether it be weather, whether it be other things. Normally, in ancient Israel, the harvest continued well into June, our June today, and even maybe later into the summer before it was completed. But Pentecost was a celebration of the first fruits of the wheat. Wave sheaf was the first fruits of the barley. Now, let's go to Exodus chapter 19. There's more to the Old Testament story. The Jews have developed their own understanding of the holy days. If you read Jewish writings, you'll find they have explanations for most of the holy days. Some of them, they don't have a biblical explanation. They sort of make one up. Trumpets has no real biblical explanation, so they have their own approach toward trumpets. The Feast of Tabernacles, of course, looking back to the time when they were wandering in the wilderness for the 40 years. So they have their own stories to tell. I want to emphasize that there's always a story, though, whether it's the Old Testament story or whether we come to the New Testament and we have a slightly different story. It's a story. And that's the same with God's holy days and his plan of salvation. Exodus chapter 19. The Jews are convicted, and certainly all their literature reflects this, based upon the timing in the Old Testament, that the Feast of Pentecost was actually the time when the law was given to Israel. But even more than that, you see, follow the story of the nation of Israel. Again, a story. The Israelites were promised certain things, or through Abraham. Abraham was promised certain things, that he would become a nation, a holy nation. We get to the Israelites are all enslaved in Egypt. Hardly a nation. You know, they're slaves. They're not a nation. And after, you know, a couple hundred years in slavery, I'm sure they had forgotten all of those promises, by and large. And Moses showing up, of course, and repeating that and telling them what was going to happen. But it didn't happen right away. There was no, quote, nation of Israel until we get to Mount Sinai. Now, they were there. They were Israelites. But they became an actual nation, the Jews believe, on the day of Pentecost, crossing the Red Sea, coming to Mount Sinai. That's when they became a nation. Now, you think about that. What does it take to make a nation? Well, you know, one of the things we know, not only is it territory, of course, they were headed for the promised land. Obviously, you have to have a leadership, and you also have to have law. So it wasn't until the old covenant is introduced to Israel that we actually have a nation of Israel. So for the Jews, Pentecost is the birth of the nation. And that's very important. Now, we're going to find out as we get to the New Testament that Pentecost is what? The birth of a spiritual nation. And you begin to see the story and how it builds layer upon layer. Verse 1 of chapter 19. Now, it's impossible to know exactly how these days all work out. But the Jews believe that when they arrive at Mount Sinai, they're there for Pentecost. And they get this, of course, in verse 1 of chapter 19. It says, in the third month, after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. Now, we don't know exactly what the same day means. Was it the same day they left Egypt? That would be the 15th day of the first month. Or was it the day they crossed the Red Sea when they finally escaped from Israel? I'm sorry, from Egypt, which was probably the 21st day of the first month. Either one of those, you go to the second month, you know, we've got 30 days. You go to the third month, somewhere in that third month, you're going to reach the 50th day. The Jews believe it was on the day of Pentecost. But notice the significance of this story. Whether it was the day of Pentecost or around the day of Pentecost, it's going to be close. But notice what happens. For they departed from Rephidim, verse 2, and came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. So Israel camped there before the mountains. And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. So here, just imagine, this is the first Pentecost, after Israel comes out of Egypt. And God declares to them, on this day or at that time, you are to become a special people if you keep my covenant. Verse 6, you shall be to me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. So Moses came, verse 7, and he spoke to the children of Israel. He told them all that God had said. He laid before them all these words which the Lord commanded him. Then all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. The covenant is now made between God and Israel. They become a nation, Feast of Pentecost, whatever year it may have been, after they departed from Egypt. So they've gone through Passover. They've gone through unleavened bread. Now they become a nation. So we have Pentecost linked in, certainly by Jewish writings, with the story of Israel and a part of their process of becoming the people of God. That's not a huge leap to come to the New Testament, the New Covenant, and find that God begins his relationship with the church and establishes what we could call a spiritual Israel, although we have to be careful as to what we mean by that term, but a spiritual nation, the church. So the stories mesh together. There's a cohesiveness. Another book that's read from the Old Testament during the Feast of Pentecost is the book of Ruth. Ruth is a transition in the story. It's a transition between the nation of Israel becoming a nation and the church being established. The book of Ruth tells a love story, and it sets the stage for the new covenant. and the spiritual body. It's the link between the two. The book of Ruth is a wonderful book. Ruth and Esther are the only two books in the Bible that bear the name of a woman. It provides a depth of understanding for us. Ruth was a Gentile woman who married an Israelite. Remember, the new covenant isn't going to be with Israel, or only Israel. The church isn't only Israel. The church was never intended to be only Israel. The nation of Israel was the nation of Israel. There's a transition. Ruth identifies that. Ruth was a Gentile woman who married an Israelite. Esther was an Israelite who was to marry a Gentile. And they both are part of the story. David clearly understood the new covenant, at least the ramifications of it, and the coming of the Messiah, as you read in Psalms. It therefore should be no surprise that David's grandmother was Ruth. And this story bridges the gap between the two. The relationship between Ruth and Boaz was mutual. The new covenant relationship is mutual, not the same as the old covenant. And both parties agree to perform. Boaz pursued Ruth. God initiates the contact with us that brings us into the church. He calls us. Ruth was a foreigner, but she was welcomed by Naomi and Boaz. Gentiles are equally welcomed in the family of God when we come to the new covenant. They're equally a part of his church. They're grafted into the natural olive tree, as Paul describes it later on. This was not true under the old covenant. The book of Ruth bridges the gap between the old covenant and Israel becoming a nation and the new covenant and the church of God beginning. It carries the story forward. We see in the book of Ruth, Boaz as a type of Christ, Ruth is a type of the church and individual Christians. This is the story of the courtship of Christ and the church. It's the basis for the new covenant. It's the love that Christ has for certainly the church and the church for one another that forms the basis of the new covenant. That was not the old covenant. The old covenant was about a nation of Israel. The old covenant had obviously laws and rules and many things that established God's connection with Israel. They were his people. The new covenant is different. The new covenant is that love relationship between God and the church, between God and Christians. God's ultimate goal is, of course, to have a family. The church is the beginning of that family. Mount Sinai, Ruth, the church. It's a wonderful story that provides instruction for us. In the Old Testament, the day of Pentecost required an act of faith, just as the wave sheaf required an act of faith. You are committed, convicted to a way of life without seeing the end. You don't know what the harvest will be like. You don't know how many will be in the harvest, whether it be the rest of the spring harvest or whether it be the fall harvest. You don't know. When you are called into the church of God and you accept Jesus Christ as your Savior, the sacrifice for your sins, you become a new person. You begin a new life. But you don't know where that's going to end. Every step of the way is by faith, just as the offering of the first fruits implies there's more to come. But you can't see what is to come. It's down the road. You step by faith. In the New Testament, we have the story continuing. But now there's a different slant on the story. Slightly different. It's still the Old Covenant, Book of Ruth, now the church, as we come to the New Testament. Luke chapter 24. Luke 24, verse 49. What has amazed me in this story is that Jesus Christ lived the first part of this story. He lived and died as the first part of the story, which is Passover. You could argue, and probably be successful, that the greatest miracle in human history would be the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, there are other miracles. The creation of the earth, the flood, the 10 plagues, all of those are great miracles. And there will be more to come. But when you think about it, This is so unpredictable, that is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. By human terms, it's unpredictable. First of all, how can a human even understand how God can die? Remember, Jesus Christ was God in the flesh. That's the way he's defined. God in the flesh died. There's no way your human mind can figure that one out. So you can state that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the most remarkable event in all human history. Yet there are other things to follow. You can only imagine the people in the New Testament time who recognized and accepted the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Well, what could be greater? What else could happen? Christ told them this, Luke 24, verse 49. He says, "Behold, I send the promise of my Father upon you." There's more to come. "But tarry in the city of Jerusalem until you are imbued or endued with power from on high." Christ told the disciples, there's more to come. You just wait. Now, if I'm a disciple at that time, what more could happen than the resurrection of Jesus Christ? What more could happen? Well, just as the Israelites, when they departed from Egypt and crossed the Red Sea, they'd have to say, what greater thing could ever happen? At Mount Sinai, they met God. Now, if you read the scriptures, Exodus chapter 19, God invited Israel to come and meet him. Then the nation of Israel began. After what they must have considered the greatest miracles that could ever happen, another miracle occurred. You get to the New Testament, the greatest miracle that could have ever happened, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And Christ said, oh, hold on, there's more to come. How could they have imagined what else would come? Well, they knew of the promise of the helper, but to understand that fully and the miracles that happened on the day of Pentecost, I'm sure most likely escaped them. But it occurred. And on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, we have all the great miracles that occurred. But the greatest miracle of all, was the baptism of 3,000 people, all of them receiving the Holy Spirit. Now we have a new body of people. Also beginning on the day of Pentecost. It's not the physical nation of Israel. It's a spiritual organism, a body, a family, headed by Jesus Christ, built by Jesus Christ, that now has a journey that's just begun to take the story to the next level, to the return of Jesus Christ, the binding of Satan, the millennial reign of Jesus Christ, and the great white throne judgment. There was more to come. Christ said, wait in Jerusalem. There's a lot more to come. You think you've seen it all? You just wait until you see what happens on the day of Pentecost. He didn't say it that way. That's what occurred. We now see the story progressing to a spiritual, from a physical to a spiritual, and revolving around this holy day. This holy day. Look at Colossians chapter 2. Now we come to the spiritual part of the story. The physical part leads us to the spiritual. The Apostle Paul lays it out this way, Colossians chapter 2, verse 16. So he said, let no one judge you in food or in drink, or regarding a festival or a new moon or Sabbaths, which are a shadow of things to come, but the substance is of Christ. So even after the day of Pentecost, the church is told there are bigger things coming. Because you see, we have four more festivals after Pentecost. There's more to come. Paul also tells us very clearly that the holy days are to point things out to us. They tell us a story. What is that story now? What is the spiritual story? You know, I believe some have erred, and I think erred quite radically, by declaring that Pentecost somehow pictures the return of Jesus Christ, some say secretly, to take the saints wherever they may take them, and the resurrection occurs. It's not only doesn't fit the physical model, it certainly doesn't fit the spiritual model. You don't have Jesus Christ coming twice, that's certainly not biblical. You don't have a rapture, that's not biblical either. Where does that come from? And what is the truth about it all? If you think about the seven festivals, while some have been fulfilled on certain days, Passover, Christ fulfilled that on Passover Day. He didn't fulfill it at the time when the lamb was actually sacrificed in the Old Testament, which would have been the evening before, but he died on Passover Day. Well, what day does unleavened bread picture? There's 7 days. It doesn't picture a day, but it pictures a removal of sin from your life that is a lifelong process. It's not a day. There's no day that unleavened bread is fulfilled. You fulfill unleavened bread throughout your life in removing sin. Now, Pentecost was truly the day, or at least around the day, that Israel became a nation and that the church begins on that day. Trumpets, does trumpets tell us that Jesus Christ must return on that physical day? Or is it not true that Jesus Christ said, no one can know the day nor the hour, that the holy days now become clear as symbols and pictures of events that will occur? 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles, how does that represent 1,000 years? And does it actually begin on the first day of the feast? How would we know? Is Satan actually bound on the Day of Atonement? These are symbols and pictures of a story, telling a story and laying it out. Now again, I don't doubt that Christ may come on the Feast of Trumpets, but it's a symbol. You must not look, because if we know that he will, and this is what has led some people to making erroneous conclusions. How many times have we heard about the return of Christ in 2012, 2011, 2009? Based on what? Well, from Passover to the Feast of Trumpets, the next year is going to be, I'm sorry, not the next year, 3 years later is going to be 1,260 days. So therefore, this event has to happen on this day, and this event has to happen on that day. Yet the Bible doesn't support that. And every one of them has been wrong. The Feast of Trumpets tells us that Christ is coming, and it'll be preceded by the trumpets and the plagues and all of that. That's what the Bible tells us. But people have always wanted to know. You know, I've always found it interesting. The one thing Christ said you can't know is what everybody wants to know. He says you can't know the day, but everybody wants to know. I mean, from the time I was in college, I've had individuals give me charts and graphs and all of the things predicting the time when Christ would return. And you pick a date. It's been ongoing for 50 years in the church and outside the church as well. We must keep in mind what the holy days tell us. We must keep in mind, we must keep our focus on what they are about and not try to come up with some sort of machinations to tell us the day that we know what is coming. The physical harvest also gives us an answer. As I said, the harvest did not end on Pentecost. There is more to the harvest. The process of harvesting the first fruits did not end at that point in time. When I was 16 years old and living on a farm, we worked a farm, we had a cotton farm, but every year we grew wheat. We planted in the late fall before the freeze, and then we harvested in the spring. A neighbor of ours who had about 1,000 acres of wheat, I was 16 years old, and he asked me if I would work for him. Through the harvest, and if I would drive a combine for him and combine the wheat in the field. And he offered me big wages at that time. I was making maybe $4 a day if my grandfather paid me for working on his farm, which is where we lived and sharecropped. He was offering me $6 a day plus a half cent a bushel for every bushel of wheat we cut. And there were two combines. I drove one, another fellow drove another. In a day with those two combines, we could cut 2,000 bushels of wheat. And I got a half cent for every bushel. You do the math, that was $10 for the wheat and $6 a day. I was making $16 a day, and I was wealthy. And we began, of course, as the wheat began to get ripe, the owner said, now it's time to start cutting. The wheat had to reach a certain level of maturity before you would begin cutting it. And then you had to be very careful, which I learned the very first day on the combine. I was so anxious to get so much wheat early on, because all I could see were dollar signs, a half cent a bushel. I was ready to go around daylight. But it was very wet, very damp. That didn't matter to me. I didn't get more than 20 feet into that first cut of wheat, and everything gummed up. The entire machine was jammed up. It was too wet. So you have to, in those days, the old combines, you had to lift the header up. You had to get underneath the header. There was a trap door there. You had to pull the trap door open. And then for the next 2 hours, I'm pulling wheat out of there. And I learned if it's too wet, it will not work. So once it's drier, later in that day, you're able to cut the wheat. We would cut the wheat, and it would, of course, be kept in the combine. We would then pour it into a truck, and that truck would take it to the grain elevator. Because, see, it's still not ready to use. You cut the wheat when the moisture level is low enough that you can cut it. It's mature enough. But then it has to mature again. And we sold our wheat to a grain elevator. A grain elevator is not a silo, but it has... it elevates the grain so that air can get underneath it and get into it. And it sits in this elevator for 2 to 6 weeks. And they measure the moisture content of the wheat. It has to be below 49% before it's ready to go to market. And some grain elevators would apply heat to it to bring about that level of moisture, bring it down, before it would then go to market and be sold. So we harvested our wheat, but it would sit in a grain elevator for a few weeks before it would actually be sold and be ready to grind up and actually have a product. Now, think of that physical analogy. The Feast of Pentecost is the sealing of the first fruits. It's the sealing of the first fruits of this spring harvest. In ancient Israel, once the wheat was cut, it was then put in sheaves and left in the field to dry more. Then once it was dry enough, it was taken to the threshing floor and it was beaten out into the grain. Then it was stored in a barn or someplace, and then it could be used. Think about the spiritual analogy. We are sealed on the day of Pentecost. The first fruits are sealed. But think about it this way. The day you were baptized was not the end of the road, was it? You were baptized, you accepted the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, repented of your sins, and you were baptized. Then what happens? You go into the kingdom then? Have you been harvested then? No, it's just starting. You've got a lifetime of storage in the barn with heat being applied until you reach that moisture level from the physical analogy. Pentecost is not the end. Pentecost is where you are sealed. You've been cut from the field. You've been selected out of the world. And now you have to mature. Feast of Pentecost is not the return of Jesus Christ. It isn't the end of that harvest. In fact, there are more steps to come. We're waiting for the return of Jesus Christ when we will be ready. You know, what does the Bible tell us? You know, it admonishes us over and over again to be ready when Christ returns, whenever that may be. We have a lifetime of heat applied to us in order to produce the product that God wants, a member of His family, a part of the first fruits. The process and the story is wonderful. Let's take a look at a couple of verses and we'll bring this to an end. Revelation chapter 17. This confirms the story. The story goes like this. Revelation 17, verse 14. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. For He is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with Him, when Christ returns, those who are with Him are whom? They are called, chosen, and faithful. Pentecost completes the called and chosen. But now you have to be faithful. That's the rest of the story. That's the story between Pentecost and the next chapter, which is the return of Jesus Christ. Called, chosen, and faithful. And then one more verse, James chapter 1, verse 18. James 1, verse 18. This is who we are. This is the story that began back in the Old Testament and continues through today. James 1, verse 18. Of His own will He brought us forth. By the word of truth, we were sealed, we were taken out of the world, we were cut out of the field, that we might be what? A kind of first fruits of His creatures. There is more to come. There is a harvest in the fall that is a much bigger harvest, much more produce, But the spring harvest, the harvest of the first fruits between the wave sheaf and Pentecost and beyond, is a wonderful, wonderful place to be. The story begins in the Old Testament. It continues through the New Testament. And it brings us to the Feast of Trumpets, the next festival, which is the return of Jesus Christ. After we've been called, we are chosen, and we are faithful. Then we join with Jesus Christ in his return, and the story continues.